From the Sky News Centre at 5, US senators are calling for a full independent investigation in the UK examining the release of the Lockerbie bomber. It was a year ago that Abdelbaset al-Megrahi was freed from prison because of his terminal cancer. He was only expected to live for 3 months. US Democratic Senator Bob Menendez says other terrorists are getting the wrong message.
It signals to them that they too can have hands stained with American blood and get away with it. And so on this unfortunate anniversary, on this unwelcome milestone, we want it to be known that our desire for answers is as strong as ever.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders have been invited to direct talks in Washington next month. It'll be the first face-to-face meeting between the two for 19 months. The 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain has been marked with a reading of one of Winston Churchill's most famous speeches. Actor Robert Hardy read extracts from the So Much Owed by So Many to So Few address 70 years after it was made in Parliament. The reading outside the war rooms was followed by a Spitfire and Hurricane flypast over Whitehall.
The task which lies before us is at once practical, simple, and stern. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task.
Drug addicts and alcoholics who fail to attend treatment could lose their welfare benefits. The idea is part of a Home Office consultation on the government's long-term drug strategy. Firefighters have been dealing with flash floods after heavy rain in parts of South Wales. Forecasters are warning of further downpours tomorrow as more wet weather's on the way. It's all going wrong for England's cricketers on the third day of the third test against Pakistan at the Oval. They've lost 5 wickets since tea and a moment ago were 210 for 8. That's a second innings lead of 135 runs. Alistair Cook has been one bright spot as he ended his poor form by hitting a century. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Get ready for BCFM's Radio Ramadan 2010, exclusively here on 93.2 FM. We'll be covering all the local Ramadan news and events, broadcasting live from mosques all around Bristol. You'll also be able to hear the Adhan called to prayer 5 times a day, hear a diverse selection of nasheeds and Quranic recitations. So come, celebrate Ramadan and Eid only on BCFM's very own Radio Ramadan, broadcasting from Monday the 9th of August till Sunday the 12th of September on 93.2 FM.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. The politicians are in the middle of their August break in Westminster and here at Bristol City Council House. So we're taking a break from them. I'm Tony Gosling. My guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Managing Director of Waste Company JTP, Julian Parry. Bouncing back from last week's holiday also is our old Labour economist, Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, former US Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, said this week that the West must bomb Iran's nuclear facilities by next Wednesday at the latest to stop their uranium enrichment programme. We take a look at the recent increased threats by the US and Israel against Tehran. And no summer break from politicians would be complete without the Bristol anarchists. With Social Security apparently about to be almost dismantled, just as people are being sacked and pay is being cut or frozen, alternatives to mainstream politics might begin to make more sense. One of the activists is from a place called The Factory, a squatted social centre in St Paul's. He doesn't like paying rent. Well, who does? And he explains where his squatters collective are coming from. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures about 19 degrees Celsius. Tomorrow, sunny periods and rain tomorrow, but dry on Sunday. A little cooler next week, around 17 Celsius, lots of sun, but clear on Monday and Friday. Next weekend, it's the 28th and 29th of August, staying cooler, about 16 degrees Celsius. Very sunny, but just a sprinkling of rain next Saturday. And the week after next, continuing around 16 Celsius, very little cloud, just the odd small drizzle. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. With me is Managing Director of a Somerset-based waste technology firm, Julian Parry. Well, welcome to Drive Time, Julian.
Well, hello, and thank you for inviting me.
Now, first, tell us about your company, JTP.
Well, JTP is an intellectual property company where we have patents on new waste systems, which we hope will take mankind into the rest of the 21st century and help recycle many more materials so that we can prevent or at least limit the amount that mankind has to rip out of the crust of the earth.
So what's unique about your type of waste disposal system then?
What we've done is to combine a number of technologies in a certain way so that we have a simple system of waste collection, which reduces the carbon footprint of that collection, and then segregates all the wastes so that they can be recycled either as useful materials such as aluminium, plastics or steel, or reduced on with the organic fraction going to become a fuel which can create electricity.
Now, I've seen your video on YouTube, and one of the things you make a big fuss about is that you think that it's actually a very bad idea to be collecting lots of different types of waste from each household, and that's very inefficient.
Well, that's segregated waste collection, and it is the basis of the last government's whole waste initiative. They would not consider anything except segregated collection. It was Eleanor Main in the Mail on Sunday many years ago, 4 years ago, who identified Monsieur Mestrelet in Paris as the guy who headed up Suez Investments, who owned CETA, as the architect of British policy on this front, and compared the French service with the British more or less self-service that we're getting now in Weston-super-Mare, where segregated collection has just been introduced and many people are very unhappy with it.
Anyway, what's your background? And I understand you stood as a Labour district councillor.
Well, my political background is that I did stand for Labour in 2003 because at that time I was trying to get influence in North Somerset Council because I thought there was something seriously wrong with the waste figures. I was on a fairly broad ticket as far as the Labour Party was concerned, but the mission was a main issue of exposing what I thought was, to put no finer point on it, fraud. And in the end, of course, the Audit Commission, it took them 5 years, produced a report which was published and is still on the web with the Audit Commission at auditcommission.gov.uk. And that was for a public information report dated about August 2008. If anybody wants to go and read it, they can.
Now, the crux of that was essentially that lorries were coming, they had some sort of, to dump off this waste, but they had some kind of ballast within the lorry, which made them appear to be heavier than they were.
It was one of the ways that the figures were being fiddled. But what surprises me is that nobody has ever denied that there was a fraud. All they've ever argued about is just how big it was.
But you were also a surveyor, weren't you, here in Bristol?
Yes, I was.
And can you tell us what you were doing then and when that was?
Well, I started off with Henry Wilcott & Company, the stonemasons company that used to repair a lot of churches and actually built the University Tower at the top of Park Street. That was built in 1926. Obviously, I wasn't employed with them, but then I came along later. But I did help rebuild the Great Hall of the University, which is a very fine piece of oak work, if anybody's ever been to see it. I then helped rebuild a lot of St. Michael's Hill and a lot of university properties and some at Clifton College. We did a lot of very fine stone buildings, but as with most things, eventually I moved on and Henry Wilcott & Company is no more.
Now, even though you did stand at one time as a Labour councillor, you were really quite annoyed with New Labour's legacy, and you have something you'd like to call the Magnificent Seven. We were chatting just before the show.
Well, yes, it's sort of leaping subjects a bit, but I did stand for Labour in 2003, but it was not long after that that I began to fall out of love with Tony Blair and his particular politics, and I'm no admirer of Gordon Brown either. And I've often been asked, you know, what was Tony Blair really all about? And I say that you have to look at his legacy to understand what the man really meant. And if we leave aside two wars, which were either very questionable or downright illegal, as some people would tell us, we have him left with the Magnificent Seven. And those are, of course, at June 2007 when he left office. He left us with then the biggest debt in history. Got bigger afterwards, but it was still the biggest then. He left us with 24-hour drinking, cannabis, B2C, cash for honours in the House of Lords, and plans for gambling casinos all across the country. They also mentioned vice in warehouses. I swear there was a spelling mistake, but it was always warehouses. I heard it three times. And, of course, they had huge plans for, and wasteful plans for waste management, which is where I've devoted a lot of my time. If we look at those Magnificent Seven again, they're really rather malignant because they represent loan sharking, bootlegging, drug running, racketeering, gambling vice, and waste cartels. And one wonders, who was he taking his instructions from? Was it God or the Godfathers?
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Now, Martin, this week, Chancellor George Osborne gave another of his big speeches at somewhere called Bloomberg. First of all, what is Bloomberg?
Well, I believe I read Bloomberg's stuff on the internet. It's a magazine, basically an investor's magazine, but quite an influential one, I believe.
So was the speech made, do you think, to reassure the city or the country or both?
Well, I don't really know what the content of it was because you haven't spelled it out, but I imagine that he's trying to keep investors happy if he's talking to Bloomberg.
OK, well, maybe we should start by us going straight into that, and maybe you can give us your answer after we've heard. So, Chancellor of the Exchequer and former member of Oxford's elite Bullingdon Club, George Osborne, gave a rallying speech in the city this Tuesday, spelling out some of the numbers behind his determined plans to reduce the national debt run up by previous governments.
Let me remind everyone of the numbers. Under current plans, we are set to tighten the public finances by a total of £113 billion by 2014-15. Of this, around £30 billion will come from tax measures. £11 billion will come from welfare reforms announced at the budget, and another £10 billion from lower debt interest costs. And around £61 billion will come from cuts to departmental expenditure. But that already included, that £61 billion already included £44 billion of cuts inherited from the previous government. So what was the plan to deliver that £44 billion of cuts? Well, I've searched for it, and I can tell you, there was no plan. Of that £44 billion, not a single penny had been allocated to any significant public spending programme. To say we must deal with the deficit, but to refuse to say how, is simply taking the British people for fools. People are debating these issues up and down the country, and anyone who is serious about tackling the nation's debts needs to come forward with an alternative plan if they don't like the plan that's in place. Both those who deny the need to cut the deficit and those who refuse to say how to do it are placing themselves outside the domestic and international debate. And in becoming deficit deniers, they are saying that they would set the country on a road to economic ruin.
Now, we're going to hear a little bit more from that speech in a minute, Martin, but, I mean, he's there talking about people who are denying that the deficit is so important as deficit deniers. I mean, would you consider that you're a deficit denier? Because you've said several weeks on this programme that actually the deficit isn't really the main issue.
The deficit is a symptom of the economic crisis. It's got to be dealt with, but the economic crisis has to be seen as a whole. It's not just a government debt crisis. The private banking system 2 years ago completely collapsed, and that is the reason why governments all over the world, not just in Britain, in Ireland, in the US, everywhere else, stepped in and propped up the private market in defiance of the free market textbook. Now, you could argue that they should have let the banks go down. That's what the free market textbook says. Nobody agreed with that, not even George Bush. So then once you've actually stepped in and propped up the private banks, then, of course, there is a deficit. Now, logically for me, a deficit must be brought down. But you don't necessarily bring it down by spending cuts in the economy, which is going to hit demand and consumption. You do need to run some kind of a deficit during a recession, as now everybody now concedes, including the Tory right. But the fact is that you can't, if you're going to bring down a deficit, you can only bring down a deficit by raising taxes on wealth. A one-off tax on wealth would raise far more money than all of the cuts that they're proposing. And of course, the real problem is that Standard & Poor's and the other ratings agencies have already started to say that because Britain is cutting its deficit, or rather cutting public expenditure, they expect the deficit to go up, which is exactly what has happened in Ireland, where they've been cutting for the last 2 years and the economy's gone down and the deficit goes up. Because macroeconomics is not a simple game of, oh, we've only got so many beans and therefore we've got to cut the number of beans, because it's actually a dynamic situation that you're in. And if the economy is allowed to flatline or go down, then of course you actually find that you've got less resources to deal with all of your problems, including the deficit. Now, there's a fundamental macroeconomic misunderstanding at the heart of all of this. And of course, George Osborne is able to make hay out of the fact that the previous Labour government also said that they were going to cut the deficit. They were also wrong in this way, because you can't cut the deficit by cutting public expenditure, which crashes the economy. The deficit then goes up. Now, we've got to actually change the terms of the debate and say we've got an economic crisis. The private banks have gone down. Those who've done very well out of the neoliberal era, the wealthy classes, must now pay for the breakages. It's like the morning after the Bullingdon Club's piss up. The time has come to pay for the breakages, and it must be the wealthy classes and them and only them who pay.
So, Martin, I mean, essentially what you're saying is that he's saying that anyone that's trying to shift the debate over to talking about something else other than the deficit is a deficit denier.
That's so what he would say, because, of course, he wants the debate to be about the deficit, whereas in actual fact it's an economic crisis debate. As I pointed out, in Ireland they've been trying to cut the deficit for 2 years following the orthodox path. The deficit is bigger. Standard & Poor's and the other ratings agencies are also suggesting that Britain, they're going to mark Britain's debt down because of the potential for a double-dip recession. Now, what that means is we could crash the car and end up with a bigger deficit, and I think that's what is going to happen. And at that point, the coalition is going to disintegrate.
So why is it you think these ratings agencies are so important? I mean, I haven't heard George Osborne talking about those at all.
That's another question, but it's a consistent part of the coalition's policy that the ratings agencies are important. Now, in actual fact, I would argue they need massively reforming because they're totally politicised. But let's assume for the moment that they are the gurus that they claim to be. What they're saying is, ooh, you're going to try and cut the deficit. Well, actually, we're going to mark down your debt from AAA, because as you try and cut the deficit, we expect a double-dip recession and we expect the deficit to get bigger. Now, this is all pretty basic macroeconomics. I studied the same degree as George Osborne and David Cameron. They've simply got it wrong from my point of view.
Now, I must bring Julian in here. Julian, there is a poll this week after the first 100 days of the condemnation catastrophe, they call it anyway, in the Daily Mirror. And they're saying that actually 57% of the people they asked are saying that the UK is on course for a second wave of recession, this double dip, and 40% disagree. We've got 4% don't knows. What's your position? Do you think that the Condemn Coalition have got it right on their economic policy to deal with the deficit in this way?
Well, I think that there is a much bigger problem. If you look at Moody's report this morning, you will find that they are worrying about the deficits, the whole imbalance of the and structural imbalance of the world's financial situation, compounded by the aging population.
Now, who are Moody's?
Moody's are another ratings agency, are they not?
Yeah, they are.
And
part
of the cartel, yes, I wouldn't disagree. But they have a rather stern message that said there wasn't a view that we had 20 years to put this right, but now they're beginning to realise that because of the ageing populations, we've perhaps only got till 2013. I, of course, look at this in an even broader context, where I think the problem has arisen since 1980 with Reaganomics and Margaret Thatcher, I must confess, where I think they made a fundamental error in mistaking and confusing making money with creating wealth. They are not the same thing. The last 30 years I brand as the age of the swindlers, where making money by fiddling people and overcharging them and interest rates on this and fees on that have taken the place of making things. Now, when I go back to 1985, I can remember it being announced on the radio that Britain was no longer going to make little metal products anymore. We were all going to be workers in factories hammering out financial products. And after 30 years of that, we can see exactly where it's got us. Now, if we compound all of that with the regulation fever that Europe has brought in, where everything has to be regulated down to the last dot and tickle, they have regulated production out of existence in a lot of cases, chased people abroad, and until that issue is also addressed, then Britain doesn't have the manufacturing or the productive capacity and structure to get us out of this hole. Anyway, they want to treat it now.
Now, you're complaining about European regulation, but we've seen the way that deregulation in the banking sector has led to the collapses of the last couple of years.
Well, you're quite right. There was deregulation, and excessive regulation are two sides of the same coin. You do need regulation. I wouldn't dispute that for one moment. But what you need is reasonable regulation. And one of the institutions I will point straight at which is causing damage, is the Environment Agency. And they have a thing called Net Regs, where they are still pounding out new regulations on a fortnightly or monthly basis. They come up on my computer, and they just cannot stop making regulations. And a lot of it, people who are in industry look at it and say, actually, this isn't necessary regulation. A lot of this is being made by bureaucrats making jobs for themselves, and for whom the Cameron Acts now cometh.
But the Environment Agency is not a European institution. Maybe it is more European regulation that we need, that they have a better brand of regulation than some of our domestic agencies and quangos.
I'm not sure that more regulation from Europe will help at all. In fact, I think Europe itself is heading for a crisis. We've seen its financial crisis, but I think it's also got a democratic crisis. Anybody who saw the way the Lisbon Treaty was bundled through on the signature of the favoured few without a referendum.
Well, they were voted for, these people. We voted for them, didn't we?
They were, but they also promised and reneged on a promise to the British people for a referendum. When other countries voted for on referenda that they didn't want to go into Europe, the French were one, the Dutch were another, and the Irish as well. What happened? They had a ratchet referenda nicely rigged to make sure they got a yes answer. And I think out of all of that, the big question that's going to come over Europe very shortly is whether or not it is still legitimate government.
Well, in his Bloomberg speech, back to George Osborne again, George Osborne was keen to stress that it will be the public, not him, that decides where the axe must fall.
Right now we are running a wise and inclusive public engagement programme to inform the spending review. Our two dedicated websites have received over 100,000 ideas from people keen to help us find ways to make savings and to transform the public sector. We will shortly be asking the public to choose some of the best of those ideas. Meanwhile, David Cameron and Nick Clegg have been holding open meetings across the country. I've hosted a series of seminars with leading professionals in many of the different areas of government activity. And at the same time, my colleague Danny Alexander has been meeting with coalition ministers from across Whitehall to discuss their department's savings. The Public Expenditure Subcommittee of the Cabinet will start regular weekly meetings at the end of this month, and I look forward to more of my colleagues joining that group as their departments agree their settlements. This spending review is a genuinely collective effort, collective around the Cabinet table and collective with the British people. Difficult choices will have to be made, not just to make the sums add up, but so that this spending review is about more than making just those sums add up. As we take decisions that will affect the budgets of government departments and public services for years to come, we have to make sure that we're shaping the economy of the future by promoting a pro-growth agenda, that we're shaping the big society of the future by empowering people, that we're shaping the public services of the future by reforming the public sector so that it delivers value for money, that we're shaping Britain's future role in the world through our review of defence and security. It is not about how much the government spends, but about what the government actually does with this money. We want to be laying the future foundations for economic growth and a fairer society. Fairness and growth. Two guiding principles we will apply to the decisions that Britain has to take.
Well, that's George Osborne again speaking earlier this week at Bloomberg magazine offices in the City of London. Julian, I'm going to get you first on this. How do you think generally, is this realistic that surely what he's doing here, George Osborne, is just being as inclusive as possible, trying to get as much information as he can about whereabouts these cuts are going to have to fall?
Yes, indeed. And I think they have no option. What we have to remember is that the last government was borrowing 25% of what it was spending. Nobody can go on like that. And obviously, when you've built up an organisation and a government has expanded to absorb and expend such funds, when you've actually got to retrench on that, you upset huge sections of society because there is a general rebalancing of the economy. And I think Martin will say that if we do that too fast, we're likely to throw ourselves into double-dip recession. I would tend to agree that there is a question of timing and a question of pace to be considered. But at the moment, they are asking questions about what they can do, where they can do it. They're not making decisions at the moment about how fast they do it. One area that I can see where there's a huge amount of money to be saved, and which I'm in a process in which I am personally engaging, is that on waste management. And I believe the country can save £4 billion a year if it abandons segregated collection.
Martin.
Yeah, well, at the very end of that clip, he just said what we're interested in is fairness and growth. Well, first of all, most of these cuts are desperately unfair. A lot of the cuts are going to be in things like schools. My sister works in a school. They know very well that she's very precarious. Her job may go. And at the same time, they're also presuming that there's going to be growth. Now, what the point that nobody seems to be getting their heads around, it's not just a question if we cut too fast, then we'll have a double-dip recession. We were likely to have a double-dip recession anyway because the private banking system has collapsed. The losses of the private banking system in the last 2 years... $118 billion from this. This is from today's Guardian. $118 billion. Now, in other words, we're actually subsidising all of that. Now, when we nationalise the banking system, which is what effectively we've done, we should have taken control of it, as we would have done in 1945, and said, right, we want you to do something for us, which is reinvest in the economy. And of course, by giving the money to the banks instead of giving it to people, we've actually there's no on lending going by the banks, because of course they're trying to rebuild their balance sheets on the basis of all this rubbish that they're holding. They need to be liquidated and bankrupted in an orderly fashion, and a whole new system needs to be put in place. Now, nobody's talking about this because we're trying to go back to the day before yesterday, and you can't go there.
Well, I think I'd like to add something to what Martin has said, because I think he's quite right, but about liquidating the banks that went broke, and we're talking about Northern Rock. And, of course, HBOS, which has nearly broken Lloyds. If we look at those, why, I ask, did Alistair Darling not immediately ask the Bank of England to step in, take over those banks, absorb all their assets, absorb all their organisations, keep the money flowing to the ATM machines, which is what the big question was, would there be enough money going around the economy for people to buy next week's groceries if the banks failed? I cannot, for the life of me, understand why we did not, as a nation, simply nationalise those banks that have been broken, and, as Martin has quite rightly said, let them put them into bankruptcy in an orderly fashion.
Can I just say the answer to that, of course, is because it's as George Osborne said in that piece, was you'll be outside the mainstream debate if you talk like this. Now, you're a businessman, you run a business, you're not a stupid person. It's not outside the mainstream debate to say that the banks should be nationalised. But could the Labour government bring themselves to say that? Could they? Could they? They couldn't. Because, of course, for them, they don't want to use the N-word. They were terrified of the whole idea of it. And I don't think the Liberal Democrat Conservative Coalition are that keen on the concept either. But it may be the only way. We'll probably have to go through another phase of crash before people start to recognise the seriousness of the situation. It is an emergency. It's not just a deficit emergency. And the wealthy people who've done very well out of this bubble must get their chequebooks out. There will have to be increases in taxes on wealth and property in order to cover the deficit, not cuts in school budgets.
Now, one of the other questions asked in this survey in the Daily Mirror this week, the first 100 days of the condemnation, was by going into a coalition with the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats have sold out on their principles. Now, that's a bit of a split there. 50% of respondents agree with that, 45% disagree with, 5% don't knows. And we're hearing also today on the news that the way that the electoral reform is being introduced is being done in such a way as to make it very difficult for the Liberal Democrats. In fact, in The Guardian, I think this is actually tomorrow's Guardian, the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg has allowed himself to be sandbagged by his Tory partners in his otherwise laudable attempt to introduce a fairer electoral system, probably losing a once-in-a-generation opportunity for electoral reform. So, Martin, do you want to just comment on this? Do you think that the way that the legislation is being introduced with a boundary commission changes as well as this electoral reform at the same time could split the coalition?
Well, it's certainly splitting the Labour Party. I mean, I'm in favour of it.
Well, the Labour Party doesn't matter in this case, does it?
No, I know, but the point is that something like an electoral reform has to have cross-party support if it's going to be successful. It's not a party political matter. Obviously, there will be people in different views, and that will depend on partly on their party and partly on their view on this particular matter. I think it's very unfortunate that we haven't got a sufficiently flexible electoral system to allow lots of a variety of different views to be consistently put. We were talking earlier about bank nationalisation. In a PR system, a section of the electorate would like to hear about bank nationalisation. But because of the way we run our system now, it's, you know, that's an unsayable say, even if it's a reasonable proposition. Now, it's a shame that we can't actually get some consensus about this, but I'm afraid it's all been very highly politicised. Now, the Labour Party opposed the referendum on the basis that this boundary reform is going to be at the same time as the referendum. So everybody's facing both ways. It's quite confusing.
Julian, what's your view on this whole thing of electoral reform? Do you think we need a different electoral system, or do you think the first past the post one works? And also, you know, how do you think this is going to be playing out in the coalition? Because if they attempt to bring these two things in at once, it may be that the Liberal Democrats simply can't support that.
Well, my view is that this falls into two categories. One is the immediate action, and the second one is the future action. The immediate action, I think that the coalition have done a marvellous job in responding to the British people's requirement at the last election to bring in coalition. And I have to take my hat off to Cameron, Clegg, and to chaps like Milburn and to Frank Field, who have all joined together to try to give us the best that they can arrange. And I think we have to acknowledge what they've done. May not agree with everything they've done, and the speed of which they do it may cause some hackles to rise, but at least they've tried to respond. However, on the question of electoral reform, I have a totally different view, and it is a completely revolutionary idea, which, if you're prepared to listen to me, I should be only too pleased. Okay, so what I would keep the first-past-the-post system, but I would have the parties funded by the public. Now, I can hear the hackles rise already, but and there is a problem with that, but it's if we don't control how they're funded. So I would say that every year Parliament had to vote on a three-choice option of how much money they were going to vote to the parties, which would be given to the Electoral Commission to distribute. The Electoral Commission would then distribute that money to the parties which were taking part in public funding on the basis of the votes cast, not of the seats taken. Now, parties which came close to success, but didn't quite, would not suffer financially for it. If we now take that idea a little step further, we can say that all the parties could have funding, provided they got a seat. But again, it will be in accordance with the proportion of their total vote. So there would become a balance at the point at which it is worth taking public funding, because they're not allowed to take private funding at the same time. And now here's the big issue, that anybody would be able to change their mind and write to the Electoral Commission and tell the Electoral Commission which party they wanted their little bit of money to go to any time they liked. Now, when a party begins doing things that are very unpopular, they would soon find themselves running out of money. And here's the last bit of it. If they got to the point where they were receiving less than 20% of the cash available, then the Electoral Commission would report directly to the Queen and ask her to get Black Rod to attend upon Parliament, because we would be having another election.
I actually agree with the financial reforms that you suggest. And obviously, a lot of the problem we have, I mean, if you look at the United States, the Wall Street insiders have paid for Obama's election campaign, so of course he has to do what they want. And politicians are under two pressures. One pressure is from the electorate, and the other pressure is from the money people. Now, in Scandinavia, of course, in places like Sweden and Denmark, that is exactly what they do. They don't actually have private funding of political parties. And of course, that to me is a sensible reform. But I think some form of proportionality in the electoral system is inevitable. We've got it in Scotland, we've got it in Wales. It was brought in Northern Ireland as an absolutely essential part of the peace process, so that everybody really did buy into the system and felt that their voice was being heard. What's happened under First Past the Post, especially with all the money involved, is that the political debate gets very narrowed down to a very narrow core. I mean, basically, elections in Britain are won in a number of constituencies around Greater London. And the kind of concerns that people in those constituencies have become the debate. And we can't talk about this because they don't want to hear about it. Whereas in actual fact, if you've got proportionality, then some parties could specialise in the inner cities and dealing with the inner cities and talking to people in the inner cities about what they wanted. Now, that doesn't mean that they get what they want, because when you've got proportionality, you then have to form the coalitions. And I do agree with coalitions. It's normal business in the rest of Europe. It's not a big deal. It's just how everybody else does it.
Now we're going to move on to discuss some of the other stories in this week's news. First of all, who will tackle failure? Now the Audit Commission is being axed. Now this is Simon Parker in The Guardian on Tuesday. So farewell then to the Audit Commission. After nearly 30 years of checking local authority books, the Commission's 2,000 or so staff will soon be out of a job. Julian, what about this? Is this a good move or bad? Because let's not forget, for example, they were in Bristol recently and they had a look at Bristol City Council, for example, gave them a zero rating on their housing benefit, the way that they were delivering housing benefit to some of the most needy in the city.
Well, the short answer is, of course, the new body that will take over is the audit is the National Audit Office. So the Audit Commission is scrapped, in my view, rightly so.
Well, why do you say that then?
Well, I have some significant experience of the Audit Commission. When I was investigating fraud in the waste flows in North Somerset, I obviously filed a major complaint with the Audit Commission as well as with the fraud squad. Now, remember, nobody has ever said that there wasn't a fraud. They've only ever complained that I said it was too big, and I still dispute that fact. But when I managed to get at one point the complaints manager at the Audit Commission to agree to send the file to the Serious Fraud Office. I have an email from him to that effect. He was then countermanded by a single bureaucrat in London in the CEO's office who said he could not do this, and she did not have a very good explanation for that as far as I was concerned, and the investigation was dropped. That was an absolute travesty, and I would urge the National Audit the National Audit Office, once it takes over, to reopen the file that the police have never closed.
Well, we'll see if they do. Martin, what's your thoughts about the axing of the Audit Commission?
Well, I was reading in the Guardian Diary earlier today that they're recruiting 20 new graduates who'd actually basically moved house to start work in the Audit Commission, and of course they've now discovered that their jobs are going to go. That's hard cheese for them, you might say. I wonder, I mean, I'm not quite sure of the structure of the National Audit Office and the Audit Commission. I mean, I do think you do need some independent oversight, which is not under the control of governments directly or under the control of private interests. Regulation is always quite tricky because regulators tend to get pally with the people they regulate, and that's one of the problems.
Julian, as someone who's had quite a bit of experience of this, what would you say makes a good regulator?
A good regulator is somebody who can take a totally objective view of something and is not swayed by personal relationships, as Martin has quite rightly said.
But how do you guarantee that? It's almost impossible, isn't it?
No, it isn't. It's by doing what the banks do with their managers, and what I think ought to happen, not only with regulators, but with senior council officials as well. They should all be on five-year contracts, and they should not be allowed to stay in one post for more than 10 years. And they should be made aware that if there's if a problem comes up that they have allowed to happen as a regulator, then they will regulate no more.
Martin, what do you think makes a good regulator?
I think one of the problems with regulation is the problem of a revolving door. So say you're trying to regulate hedge funds. The kind of people who know about hedge funds tend to get those jobs. And then, of course, when they're finished after their 5 years, they go back to the hedge funds that they're regulating. Mm. Now, there is an argument for having, as we've had in this country for quite a while, a genuinely independent career civil service, where people do not, in fact, expect to end up in the private sector when they've done their 5 years in the public sector, because that then gives them the independence from the private sector that should, in theory, allow them to do their job properly. Although, of course, what tends to happen even so is they get pally with the people they're regulating, and so it's an inevitable problem. It's like the police are always trying to catch criminals, but there's always going to be the problem that criminals are clever and it's difficult to catch them.
£100 million worth of services are to be privatised. This was in the Bristol Evening Post on the 12th of August. Services worth £100 million are to be privatised in a bid to slash cash from North Somerset Council's budgets. But the authority says no jobs will be lost. The council has agreed to award a contract for the delivery of a number of support services, including revenues, benefits and business improvement and procurement, to contractor I don't know if I can pronounce this, Agilisys Limited. The contract will also see the authority's IT, payroll, facilities management and print unit, as well as some finance, payroll and HR functions handed over. Julian, is this a good thing?
I must confess, this is a story that I only came up against a few days ago, and it is not one that I have researched deeply. However, I have read the statements by Nigel Ashton, North Somerset's leader, and I think that there is a discontinuity between the claim that standards will be better and there will be cost savings and nobody will get the sack. I just cannot see that that is going to equate. Also, we don't know who this new company is, and I must find time to research a company's house to find who are on the board of directors and see if any old-fashioned names crop up again to remind us of the past.
What do you mean, to remind us of the past?
Well, there is a... I don't want to do the present directors of Agilis a disservice here, so I have to be careful what I say. But I am aware of other revolving doors that Martin has just quite rightly referred to, where the good old boys get together. They are the inner circle who control us. And that's one of the reasons why I want to see them all on five-year contracts on the slightest stepping out of order, and they are on five-year contracts no more for the rest of time.
Of course, one of the big problems with this is when these services are privatised, they become much more secret. The move to privatise services has been condemned by unions who've accused the council of acting secretly, it says in the Evening Post article. Unison is calling on the authority to make the full details of the business case for privatisation available to the public.
I think Unison is absolutely right on this one. I've got no problem with that demand. There has to be transparency in so many things. One of the real problems we have in government today has been the lack of transparency in all sorts of areas, and in North Somerset particularly, where I have watched it for some years, lack of transparency and lack of proper consultation, indeed false consultation, has been something that has blighted our lives for some time in the past.
It's a bit surprising though, Martin, isn't it, that this £100 million worth of services are being privatised, but actually the details of the business case is secret.
Well, a lot of the private finance initiatives, similarly, I mean, it's commercially confidential. I mean, millions and billions of taxpayers' money are committed to these deals, but we're not allowed to know what's in them because it's commercially confidential, which I think is completely unacceptable, frankly.
There is another issue as well, and this was brought up on Watchdog, was it, at the BBC not so long ago, again about North Somerset, where the budget for consultants was huge. Now, what happens is that senior officers are faced with an issue because of pressure from central government, or usually from central government. They then employ a consultant to tell them what to do, and some of us believe that around the back door they tell the consultant what to consult, the consultant duly consults it, and the officers put in place exactly what the officers want. And that's another reason why we need them on five-year contracts, and the public need to realise that when they elect a councillor, they're electing somebody who is really a frontispiece. The real power, especially since the advent of the executive system of government, which was brought in 2001, since that came in, power has essentially passed from the elected body to the permanent staff and the permanent senior staff, and our democracy has been damaged.
Martin, I see you nodding there just now.
Well, obviously I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I did some research a couple of years ago for Bristol Debt Advice Centre about bailiff collection of council tax. And one of the problems in North Somerset is that it's actually a private firm that does the collection. So if you've got some complaints about bailiffs, then you don't, and you go to the council, they just say, well, we don't do that anymore. You have to speak to these people who are completely independent of us. Now, that actually is a derogation of democratic control. And what makes people think that private contractors who have got a bottom line to fulfil are necessarily going to be more efficient than a well-run public bureaucracy? I think we've got to get the idea. Public bureaucracies can be well-run. There's no reason why they can't be if they're properly managed. It's a management issue, isn't it?
It's more than a management issue. It's a quality of staff issue when you start to look at senior officers. And there, I think, there are issues. And I have witnessed a growing tendency for these chaps to parcel out their own duties out to consultants, out to contractors, as in this case. And then we ought to ask the question, well, if there's all been done by contractors behind closed doors, why do we need these people to be there in the first place? And what is the point of electing councillors? And again, I think we're beginning to have to look not just at Europe, but at our own administrations to ask whether or not we are now in the grip of illegitimate government, and perhaps that's why we've got financial problems.
Well, staying with North Somerset, Western Pier needs repairs before it can open. The new wooden decking on the new £51 million pier in Western Supermare may need to be replaced, possibly causing even further delays. Well, almost, I would say almost certainly causing even further delays in the opening. Pier owner Kerry Michael has admitted that the new wooden decking around the outside of the pavilion is already failing, and structural engineers have been called in to assess the problem. This comes after the Bristol Evening Post exclusively revealed that one of the main subcontractors working on the project had gone bust.
Kerry Michaels has done Weston a huge favour. The man has invested £50 million after the pier burned down, unfortunately. But in fact, we are the town probably needed a new one anyway. So we've got this fine new building going up, and I'm sure that Mr. Michaels is extremely frustrated. In fact, I know he's frustrated at the lack of progress, at the delays, and at the knock-on effects that all these things are causing. And to have a major contractor go down on him at this particular point in time must be extremely frustrating for the man. The only thing I can think that we do now is go down and look at the signboard that's on the promenade that says opening summer 2010, take the naught out at the end and put a one there, because I think it'll be another year before it opens the way things are going.
But to what extent do you think this is just unfortunate bad luck, and to what extent is it mismanagement and actually bad management of the whole rejuvenation process for the pier?
I have to look at the speed with which it's done, and if you look, they've done that in 18 months. To get that far in 18 months shows that they must have had some pretty good managers on it one way and another. You do not put a project like that together after a fire and get a building like that up and running in 18 months without having some pretty class operators on there. Okay, they've got problems and something's gone wrong. I'm not privy to what's actually gone wrong. All I do know is, and from what we hear around the town, Mr. Michaels is very far from being amused, and I can understand why.
Martin, do you have any comments on this?
Well, it seems to be that a subcontractor working on the project has gone bust. I mean, surely that's because of the situation in the rest of the economy. It's not the pier that's made them go bust, it's other things that they're involved in. And that just highlights for me the dangers of a double-dip recession, where projects that ought to go ahead just don't go ahead because one piece of the jigsaw is missing because of the general situation.
Julian, I just wonder whether you can see a way forward for the rejuvenation of Western Supermare. There's lots of work going on the beach there as well, and the pier.
Well, there's been a lot of development in Western Supermare over the last 5 years, ever since 2005 when Knightstone was taken over by Redrow. And I must say, all of it is tainted with the suspicion that the right thing has not been done. In the case of Tropicana, which is still a mess and is noted on Google Earth as Weston's disgrace, the place is still in a mess. And the one thing that I was disturbed to find was that the water that has flooded the basement that caused its closure is actually tap water. And we've had it analysed at NAMAS accredited labs. The matter has been passed to the police. Again, nothing happened. But we believe the property was originally sabotaged. We've got other reasons for saying that. When we go to Knightstone Island, we find that in 2003, the Lib Dems newspaper, the Clarion, announced it should be used for public purposes. In 2005, they rescinded a lease of £60,000 a year, which had been running since 1992, and it was a lease of 125 years, and they gave Redrow a 250-year lease at £1 a year. When I asked the county solicitor what had happened to the 6.75 million that had disappeared, I got a very, very restrained answer, let me put it that way. When we look at the splash wall that's been built, we started off with a £7 million budget, then it was 17. Now I understand it's 30 and it's gone over budget by a significant sum. And yet they only had to put 3-inch coping stones on the wall a couple of weeks ago, and they had to close the front because the water was already coming over it. That wall will not work. And other ideas for a hydraulic wall, all sorts of things that could have brought people in from hundreds of miles around, were just totally swept aside. Again, false consultation by the favoured few who don't listen to anybody else.
Oh dear. Well, Marina Morris is joining us now, and she's going to take us on to another subject. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. We will talk about working mother. Is it possible for a woman to have a good career and to be a good mother? Imagine that you are a young lady and sitting now with your friends at the restaurant table, dreaming about your future career and plans to have a family and children. How do you plan to achieve both of these goals? Imagine 30 years later, everyone from your company comes to this restaurant. Only everyone is sitting on separate tables, their own family, children, husband or wife, or without a family, an empty table. Everyone looks different. What choices and sacrifices have people made? What outcome will represent a successful life for you? Which lifestyle model is the most attractive to you? If we are talking in terms of the quality of life, can you feel happy and satisfied by life if you valued only your career in your 60s? Will you look back and regret your past? If a woman dedicates her life only to her family, she doesn't develop her own skills, hasn't a profession or career, is this a good role model for her children in the 21st century? Can this mother prepare her children to compete in today's high-pressure world and win the game of life? Can she expect her children to aspire to a good career and happy life? Children learn by example and inherit their parents' behavior pattern. Will she regret that she didn't develop her potential and had poor expectation of herself? If you don't develop your talents, they are at risk of dying. A woman needs to strike a balance for herself between these competing priorities. It is her duty, if she decide to become a parent, to maintain, nurture and develop her children. Statistics show that women do it very well. According to statistics from the National Statistics Office in 2008, 68% of women of working age with children were in employment, compared to 73% of women in the same age group without children. 57% of women with children under 5 were in employment, representing the time when perhaps demand on a mother's time with no child care from school is greatest. By the time the youngest child was in the range 5 to 10 years old, 71% of women were in work, broadly comparable this woman with no children. By the time children were in the 11 to 16 group, 78% of mothers were working, perhaps representing long suppressed working aspirations. Perhaps this is more about a desire for additional income. The statistic also shows that women are much more likely than men to be in part-time of work, particularly women with children. Men with children are much more likely to be in work than men without children.
Thanks, Marina. Well, in last week's Daily Mail, actress Emma Thompson raised the issue, is it possible for mums to be career women too? Well, clearly it is, but Friday Drive Times' Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol to get your opinion.
Is it possible for a woman to have a good career and to be a good mother?
Yes, there's a balance in terms of meeting the children's needs when they are young, but I would say most definitely yes, and society should adapt employment to suit women to be able to have children and to be able to balance their career.
Well, I'm currently pregnant and I'm working at the moment, and I suppose I'm already thinking of how I'll manage everything. So I think it is possible, but I could see that maybe I wouldn't progress as well as maybe if I didn't have children. You know, I'm thinking I'd like to work less and things like that. So I think, yeah, you can have a career, but maybe not as good as you might have if you didn't have children, maybe. It depends on your outlook, I guess, if you're more family-orientated or more work-orientated.
Why shouldn't they? There's no difference between a woman and a man in the workplace. There's no reason why they can't get further in their career. There's opportunities for them to have their children looked after while they're at work. I see no problem.
It's a good question, because my wife is just going to maternity leave, actually. It is a little bit difficult. Yeah, you can be a good mom, yeah, that is natural, but it's very difficult to have both together at the same time because of some sort of discrimination or, I don't know, pressure in job. So when you come back home, obviously it will affect you.
What is the impact on the family and children if a woman prioritizes her career?
If parents, a mother can pay for a child to go to a nursery, in terms of their education and development, I think it's better that way, that they have a balanced upbringing in terms of being in a nursery, plus also being looked after by their mother.
Depending on the support you have, like say if you focus on the career and your partner does more the home thing, then I guess that would work out okay. But if both of you are, you know, just focused on your careers, I think the children would suffer in terms of their attachment and their confidence. And I think they do need to be around a parent quite a lot, particularly in the early years. The first 15 years of your life dictate the other 70, really. So it's important to be there as much as you can.
It may depend on the age of the children. I think sometimes that the children perhaps are looking for a mother to be around quite a lot in the time when they're growing up. But the older they get, then it's not perhaps so much important as it is when they're actually younger.
If a woman dedicates her life to her family, what happens when her children grow up?
You set an example to your children. I know that from experience that my children, seeing their mother go to university and to see me to also study, and they will pass that on to their own children to know that they can have a career also.
Yes, well, that's the dilemma. I think that's why it is important, if you can, probably to keep a balance. Because if you do give over everything to your children, well, it's important to give over, you know, almost everything that you can, but I think when they do go away, then you could be left quite socially isolated and maybe regretting that you didn't, you know, focus more on your career, and you could be kind of feel like you've been a bit kind of left behind and in a bit of a rut and isolated maybe.
Once the children have gone, then you want to do something. So therefore, yes, obviously heading back to work is probably the first thing to do. Well, then that's right. But then if she's had previous experience maybe in the career that she's chosen, then I think people are looking for experience, even if you've had that little time off from work.
Can you think of a good role model who balances these competing priorities?
I can't think of anyone famous, but I know that in my relationship and other people's relationship in work, that they have a good balanced career, and also as a mother, your life isn't just about bringing up children. What happens after the children have left the nest and grown up?
Well, I know somebody in my own life, somebody I used to work with, who would be a very good career woman. Like, she's done very well and has contributed to books and edited books, and she works in mental health. She would be very good with people and has done lots of good work and seems to have raised her children very, very well as well. But there was a partnership there. I think her husband has been good as well. And she reduced her hours when they were small and then managed to go back a bit more. And as they got bigger and they needed her less, then she focused a bit more on her career. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe when they're young, stay at home as best you can. And when they start growing up and having their friends, go back and focus on your career a bit more. Maybe that's the secret. I don't know. I'll tell you in about 10 years.
So, Julian, do you want to start on this one? What do you think it's okay getting the balance right? Mums, between their career and their children, is that happening okay at the moment, do you think? Or are we putting too much pressure on women to work?
I think there's an awful lot of pressure on women to work. And I think that probably there are an awful lot of women wish that pressure wasn't there. But at the same time, I think it's very difficult to generalise about what should happen, because circumstances on an individual basis change so much. You know, there is a huge difference between the situation of a mother who's a single parent who's been abandoned one way or another with children, and the problem with, a well-established 2.4 children at a well-established home.
I think the key to all of it is basically childcare. When we're talking about Scandinavia earlier and their the way they fund their political parties and so on, but in countries like Finland, there's been universal nursery education for all children from the age of 3 until 7 since the 1930s. And in the very long run, that makes a huge difference to the kind of society you have. Whatever family you've got, you've got at least 4 years of solid nursery education behind you by the age of 7. They don't try and teach them to read till they're 7 in Scandinavia. And we could build a whole new generation of nursery schools and reflate the economy on that basis.
Well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6 now, thanks to this week's guest, Managing Director of Waste Company JTP, Julian Parry. After the news, this week, former US Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, said that the West must bomb Iran's nuclear facilities by next Wednesday, would you believe, to stop their uranium enrichment program. The US hawks want another war, do they? Or is this just more saber-rattling? We take a close look at the increased threats by the United States and Israel against Tehran. And no summer break from politicians would be complete without the Bristol anarchists. With Social Security apparently about to be almost dismantled, just as people are being sacked and pay is being cut or frozen, alternatives to mainstream politics might begin to make more sense. One of the activists from The Factory, a squatted social centre in St Paul's, is here. He doesn't like paying rent. Well, who does? And he explains where his squatters collective are coming from. Join us after the news.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.